This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we talk about the civil rights speeches of Martin Luther King.
Let us be dissatisfied until the tragic walls that separate the outer city of wealth and comfort from the inner city of poverty and despair shall be crushed by the battering rams of the forces of justice. Let us be dissatisfied until slums are cast into the junk heaps of history and every family will live in a decent sanitary home. Let us be dissatisfied until the dark yesterdays of segregated schools will be transformed into bright tomorrows of quality integrated education. Let us be dissatisfied until integration is not seen as a problem, but as an opportunity to participate in the beauty of diversity. Let us be dissatisfied until men and women, however black they may be, will be judged on the basis of the content of that character, not on the basis of the color of that skin. Let us be dissatisfied. Let us be dissatisfied until every state capital be housed by a governor who will do justly, who will love mercy, and who will walk humbly with his God. Let us be dissatisfied.
That's an excerpt of Martin Luther King's address to the 11th Annual Convention of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in Atlanta in August of 1967. Some of King's most famous speeches, as well as some previously unpublished ones, are collected in a new book and a companion series of cassettes called A Call to Conscience. My guest, Claiborne Carson, is the co-editor of this project. He also directs the King Papers Project, which is responsible for editing and publishing King's writings. Carson is a history professor at Stanford University. We invited him to choose a few excerpts from King's speeches and to share some of his thoughts about them. Let's start with King's first civil rights speech. He delivered it on the first day of the Montgomery bus boycott in December of 1955. I asked Claiborne Carson about the occasion for the speech.
We wouldn't be talking about Martin Luther King if not for Rosa Parks, because it was her action on December 1st, 1955, of refusing to give up her seat on a bus that started the Montgomery bus boycott. And it was actually Rosa Parks and Montgomery women who thought up the idea of the boycott and passed around thousands of leaflets and were able to successfully get nearly all of Montgomery's black residents to stay off the buses on Monday the 5th. And at that point, the ministers in town, most of them, all of the men, decided to get together and form the Montgomery Improvement Association. And that was when they selected Martin Luther King to lead this boycott movement that had already begun. And he was asked to address a major rally that was going to be held at Holt Street Baptist Church that night. And as he recalled later, he only had a few minutes, maybe 15 to 20 minutes, to prepare what was the most decisive speech of his life, because this was his first major speech to a public audience.
He says that this is a movement of Christians, that he once had said that we are not here advocating violence. The only weapon that we have in our hands this evening is the weapon of protest. Where was he when he gave this speech in his thinking, in his development about civil disobedience?
Well, first of all, he was not really a accomplished practitioner of Gandhian nonviolence. At that point, he even a few weeks later applies for a gun permit, which might be surprising. He had not really made his commitment to nonviolence, or at least Gandhian nonviolence, as a philosophy of life. That would come later. But even at this early stage, he understands that nonviolence is a necessity as a tactic. And I think that what you see coming out of this speech is an understanding of how it was related to the long-term struggle for civil rights under the Constitution of the United States.
What did he plan on doing with the gun, do you know?
Well, it was for protection. He got many threats during the first few weeks of the protest. There was times when he thought that he had made a mistake by agreeing to become the leader. Rosa Parks, she writes an introduction to this speech for the volume, And one of the things that she points out is that part of the reason why King was selected was because he was new. And therefore, as a minister in town, he didn't have any enemies. There was also the thought that maybe a young person without a lot of responsibilities, if someone had to go to jail, it might as well be him as opposed to maybe a minister with a large family or someone else like that. But I think it was largely the fact that he was the newcomer in town and he hadn't really developed the enemies that might have come later.
There's a couple of short excerpts from this first civil rights speech that Martin Luther King gave that you'd like us to hear. Would you introduce the first part for us?
Well, I think that when we look at this speech, we see so many of the themes that he develops in his later speeches that are also included in the volume, particularly his understanding that the movement is about gaining, realizing the ideals of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. So in this excerpt, he talks about if we are wrong, if we in Montgomery who are carrying on this protest are wrong, the Supreme Court of the nation is wrong, the Constitution is wrong, God Almighty is wrong. So I think he develops that theme with a passion and an eloquence that is remarkable.
This is Martin Luther King on December 5th, 1955.
And we are not wrong. We are not wrong in what we are doing. If we are wrong, the Supreme Court of this nation is wrong. If we are wrong, the Constitution of the United States is wrong. If we are wrong, God Almighty is wrong. Jesus of Nazareth was merely a utopian dream that had never came down to earth. If we are wrong, justice is a law. And we are determined here in Montgomery to rock and fight until justice runs down like water.
That was an excerpt of Martin Luther King's first civil rights speech given in 1955. Claiborne Carson has just edited a book and a set of cassettes called A Call to Conscience, collecting the civil rights speeches of Martin Luther King. Claiborne Carson, what would you say about Martin Luther King's oratory style in this first civil rights speech compared to his style later on?
Well, I think, first of all, you see how he is such an accomplished orator, even at this early stage. At this point, he is still 26 years old. He is a person who has only spent a year as a minister of a church, but yet you see that power, that confidence. The fact that he only had a few minutes to prepare the speech meant that most of it was going to be extemporaneous. I think that what you see there is a remarkably accomplished orator at a very young age.
Let's skip ahead to the end of this first civil rights speech given by Martin Luther King. Tell us a little bit about what to listen for.
Well, again, what King tries to do here is try to take a local event. At this point, it's a one-day bus boycott. So we don't even know that it's going to succeed. We don't even know if it's going to go on for any length of time. It actually ends up going on for more than a year. But we don't know that at this time. But what King is able to do at the end of that first day is tell his audience that they are involved in a historic protest, something that will be written about in the history books of the future. And he understands that this is an important moment in African-American history. There lived a race of people, a black people, a people who had the moral courage to stand up for their rights, and they had injected new meaning into the veins of history and civilization.
Let's hear his conclusion to this speech.
As we stand and sit here this evening, and as we prepare ourselves for what lies ahead, let us go out with a grim and bold determination that we are going to stick together. Yeah. in the future. Somebody will have to say, down in the race of people, of black people, speaking less than black from flesh. But our people who have the mind of courage to stand up for their rights. And we are going to do that. God grant that we will do it before it is too late. As we proceed with our program, let us think of these things.
That's the end of Martin Luther King's first civil rights speech, given at the beginning of the Montgomery bus boycott in December of 1955. When Martin Luther King was talking about this being the beginning of a very important movement, do you think he had any idea that he would be the leader of that movement?
I think he understood that he was going to play a leadership role, because at that time, that's what black ministers did. His father had been a minister. His grandfather had been a minister. His great-grandfather had been a minister. His grandfather and his father had been leaders of the NAACP. So he understood that he was going to play a leadership role. That was one of the reasons why he became a minister, because it was one of the few areas where a black person was able to perform a leadership role, but also have a certain amount of independence, because it was one of the few professions where a black person was not dependent upon whites to pay their salary. So I think the leadership was always there. He didn't understand the scale of the leadership. I think that that was something that was more thrust upon him. And I think he had a lot of ambivalence about that, because he saw it, civil rights leadership, as subordinate to his role as being a minister. Eventually, that began to take over from that role and began to become the center of his life, something that dominated his life, even to the point where he was not able to often show up on Sunday morning to deliver the sermon and to take care of his family responsibilities.
My guest is Claiborne Carson, co-editor of the new book and cassette collections of Martin Luther King's civil rights speeches. It's called A Call to Conscience. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Claiborne Carson, co-editor of A Call to Conscience, a new book and cassette collection of Martin Luther King's civil rights speeches. Let's skip ahead to the final speech that Martin Luther King gave, and this was the day before he was assassinated. This was April 3rd of 1968 in Memphis, Tennessee. What was the occasion of this address?
Well, this was one of those addresses that he hadn't planned to give. He had been called back to Memphis. In some ways, Memphis as a whole was one of the accidents of the movement. He had not intended that to be the major focuses of his activity, but the Memphis garbage worker strike was something that he could not avoid. The first decision he makes is not to go at all. He's very tired, very exhausted. He wants to send Ralph Abernathy to speak for him. But quickly he gets the message that the people there are very, very excited. They're very enthusiastic. They want to hear him. And he decides to come. And of course, at this point, he doesn't have a prepared text. But what's remarkable about the speech, he obviously doesn't know it's going to be his last speech, but in it, he's able to look back over his career and reflect on the meaning of it. And he goes through and talks about the incident in 1958 when he is stabbed by a deranged woman who stabs him with a knife that comes very close to his heart. His doctor tells him if he had sneezed, he would have died because that would have punctured his heart. And he says, I'm glad I didn't sneeze, because if I had not lived past that, I would not have been there for the sit-ins in 1960, for the freedom rides. So he understands the significance of his life and how these events have culminated in the Memphis struggle.
This is the speech that's most famous for his lines about how he'd been to the mountaintop.
That's right. But I think that that's the part of the speech, just the way I would compare it would be, we only hear often the I Have a Dream speech, we only hear the end of it. And many of the most interesting parts are before that, but King, to some degree, has been reduced to a soundbite. And I think the same with the last speech. We tend to hear the last part, I've been to the mountaintop, which, of course, is a great culmination, a great climax to the speech. But the earlier part of the speech, I think, is the most interesting, the most revealing, because that's where he's able to articulate his understanding of the importance of his own life.
There's a particular moment in this speech that I know you'd like us to hear with an image that you particularly like. Would you just tell us why you've singled out this particular passage?
Well, I think that for King, the crucial event of the civil rights struggle was the confrontation in Birmingham between Bull Connor and the mostly young people who were marching against his police dogs and the fire hoses. And he focuses on this moment because he understands, and I think he wants his audience to understand, that the forces that they represent, the forces of people marching for their own freedom, are stronger than the forces of oppression.
Here's Martin Luther King.
We aren't going to let any mace stop us. We are masters in our nonviolent movement in disarming police forces. They don't know what to do. I've seen them so often. I remember in Birmingham, Alabama, when we were in that majestic struggle there. We would move out of the 16th Street Baptist Church day after day. By the hundreds, we would move out, and Bull Connor would tell them to send the dogs for. And they did come. But we just went before the dogs singing, "Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around." Bull Connor next would say, "Turn the fire hoses on." And as I said to you the other night, Bull Connor didn't know history. He knew a kind of physics that somehow didn't relate to the transphysics that we knew about. And that was the fact that there was a certain kind of fire that no water could put out.
It's an excerpt of Martin Luther King's final speech given the day before he was assassinated. Are there any specific issues that you're thinking about on this Martin Luther King Day?
I think for me, part of what I see represented by this day is a time to remember how strong the ideas of Martin Luther King are. We often think of him in a very limiting way as a civil rights leader, particularly as an African-American civil rights leader. But his significance goes far beyond that, and his ideas have had an impact far beyond that. The thing I would like to emphasize is the importance of nonviolent struggles in the world today. We've seen over the last 50 years in so many different nations, in the Philippines and South Africa, in Eastern Europe, the way in which struggles that were once assumed could only be resolved through violence were resolved largely through nonviolence. And I think in each of those cases, we see the influence and the impact of Martin Luther King's ideas. He's, in many respects, I think, respected and revered more outside the United States than inside the United States because, again, many Americans tend to limit him by thinking of him simply as an African-American civil rights leader.
What do you think King might say if he were alive today about the politics of race today?
Well, I think, first of all, he would put the politics of race in a larger context. He always understood that the African-American struggle was part of a larger struggle of oppressed people, and particularly people who are economically oppressed. His emphasis on the gap between the rich and the poor, that would be even a stronger message from Martin Luther King today than it was then, because Of course, we've achieved many of the goals that he struggled for in terms of race relations, but we are far away from achieving the goals that he spent the last few years of his life struggling for, and that is the goal of economic democracy, the goal of trying to take care of the needs of those who are most oppressed in our society.
Claiborne Carson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Claiborne Carson, he co-edited A Call to Conscience, the new book and cassette collections of King's civil rights speeches. Carson is a history professor at Stanford University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.